he was yelling into his phone. Send it now! Send it now! Hannah and I exchanged a glance.
That's his sister,
she said quietly, and I thought, that's the journalist, and my peaceable mood dissolved. I was making a cheese omelette and whisked the eggs furiously, trying to lose the dark thread of my thoughts in domestic tasks. Since Liza had told me her plans, I had never cooked so hard, nor the hotel been so clean. Pity there were no other guests. They would have had a rare five-star service. I stuck my head down and whisked until I had forgotten what I was thinking about, and I had eggs so light they were ready to fly out of the bowl. It was several minutes before I noticed that since Mike's shout, there had been no noise at all from upstairs, not even the usual padding of his feet as he moved from desk to leather chair or the creak as he lay down on his bed. Once again, Hannah was engrossed in her exercise book, but there was a quality to the silence that made me curious. I took the pan off the heat and walked to the doorway. Mike, I called up the stairs. Everything okay? Nothing. Mike, I said, holding the banister and taking a step up. Kathleen, he said, and his voice was tremulous. I think you'd better come up here. As I entered the room, he told me to sit down on the bed. In truth, he was so pale, so unlike himself, that it was a couple of seconds before I agreed to do so. He moved towards me and squatted in front of me, like someone about to propose. Then he said those two little words, and, as I heard them spoken aloud, I felt the colour drain from my face. Afterwards, he told me he was afraid I'd have a stroke, like Nino Gaines. He was a fool, I thought, with the part of my mind still capable of functioning, or a madman. We'd been harbouring a madman all this time. What the hell are you saying? I asked, when my voice returned to me. What kind of joke is this? Suddenly I felt furious with him, and he waved a hand at me, telling me, uncharacteristically rudely, to shush, to wait while he opened his computer. He stood up and, as I began to protest, scanned down a load of messages. Then, as I wondered whether I should try to leave the room, a little box opened on his screen, and there she was. Unbelievably, in full colour, staring at us with a wary incomprehension that matched my own, and my hands began to tremble. This is the picture Monica took today. It looks like her, right? My mouth hung open, and my hand was glued to my chest. I was unable to tear my eyes away from that face, and then, in halting sentences, he told me what his sister had told him. Hannah, I croaked. You've got to get Hannah. But Hannah must have become curious about what was going on upstairs, because when I looked away from the screen, she was already in the doorway, her pen still in her hand. Her eyes flickered from me to Mike and back again. Hannah, sweetheart, I said, lifting a trembling hand towards the computer, I need you to look at something. I need you to tell me whether this looks like...
Letty!
Hannah moved closer to the screen, lifted a finger, and traced her sister's nose.
Letty!
She's alive, sweetheart, I said, as the tears came. I couldn't speak properly for several minutes, and I felt Mike's hand on my shoulder. God save us, she's alive! And I was afraid for Hannah. Afraid that she would be feeling even more than the shock and disbelief I felt. My thoughts were in turmoil, my heart numbed by the sight of that child whom I'd never known, but whose life and death had hung over this house as surely as if she'd been my own. How on earth could we expect Hannah to cope with this? But she was the only one of us not crying.
I knew,
she said, a great smile breaking across her face.
I knew she couldn't be dead, not like the sea creatures. She never felt dead.
She turned back to the screen and traced the image again. They were so alike. It was as if she was staring into a mirror. It's hard to believe now that I could have doubted it. Mike had gone to the window. He was rubbing the back of his head. "Those bastards," he was saying, forgetting Hannah's presence. "How can they have kept the truth from her for all those years? How could they do that to her? How could they do that to the child?" The size of their deception had hit me too, and the language that emerged from my mouth I haven't heard since I was a wartime barmaid. "That bastard! That yellow-bellied, rat-eating son of a rabid dog! That shark," suggested Mike, raising an eyebrow. "Shark," I affirmed, glancing at Hannah. "Yes, shark. I'd sure love to gut him like one."
"I'd shoot him," said Mike.
"Shooting's too good." I had a sudden image of old Harry, my harpoon gun, mounted on the wall of the Whale Chasers Museum, and had a thought that would have shocked those who knew me. I knew Mike's mind was headed the same way. Then Hannah spoke again.
"I still have a sister," she announced,
and the simple delight in her voice stopped us both.
"Look, I have a sister."
And as Hannah placed her own face beside that oversized image, so that we could both take in the reality of that statement, Mike and I turned to each other. "Liza," we said in unison. We didn't know how to tell her. We didn't know how to give her this news. She was out on the boat, and it was too huge, too shocking to tell her over the radio. Yet we couldn't wait for her to come in. In the end, we borrowed Sam Grady's cutter. With Mike and Hannah at the prow and me at the tiller, we sailed out past the bay to Breaknose Island. The breeze was light, the seas gentle, and within minutes we were accompanied by pods of dolphins, the joyful arcs of their bodies echoing the mood on our boat. As we bounced across the waves, Hannah leant over the edge and told them.
"They know," she said, laughing. "They've come because they know."
For once I didn't put her straight. Who was I to say how life worked? Who was I to say those creatures didn't know more about it than I did? I felt at that moment that nothing would surprise me. And there she was, coming back in, standing at the helm with Millie beside her, looking forward already to coming ashore. She had a full boat, largely Taiwanese. The tourists leant over the front rails, curious as to why we had approached, some still clutching their cameras, then snapping madly as they saw the dolphins in our wake. As she spotted us and steered towards us, the sun was behind her, and her hair looked as if it was on fire. "What's up?" she yelled as we pulled alongside. She forgot to be mad about Hannah not wearing a life jacket. When she saw the three of us crammed into the little boat, she knew we couldn't be there for any ordinary reason. I looked at Mike, who nodded at me, and I began to shout. But even before I had even said the words, the tears were streaming down my face. My voice broke. It took several attempts and Mike's proffered hanky before I could make myself heard.
"She's alive, Liza! Letty's alive!"
Liza looked from me to Mike and back again. Above us, two gulls wheeled and cried, mocking what I had said.
"It's true! Letty's alive! Mike's sister has seen her! She's really, really alive!"
I waved the picture that Mike had printed off, but the breeze whipped it round my hand and she was too far off to see it.
"Why are you saying this?"
she said, her voice cracking with pain. She glanced back at the passengers, who were all watching the scene intently. The colour had drained from her face.
"What do you mean?"
Struggling to keep my balance, I unfurled the picture and held it above my head in two hands like a banner.
"Look!" I shouted. "Look! They lied to you! The bastards lied to you! She never died in the car crash! Letty's alive! And she's coming home!"
The tourists hushed, and a few of the Taiwanese, perhaps sensing the enormity of the occasion, began a spontaneous round of applause. We waited below, our faces alive with joy and expectation, and then, as the gulls flew off on some predetermined path, Liza turned her face briefly towards the sky and fainted clean away.
Mike said he'd never realized how much he loved his sister till that day. In a 3-hour conversation, as Liza sat pressed up to him, still pale with shock, she told him how she had arranged to meet Stephen Villiers at his office and once there, cup of tea in hand, told him she was following up a story about a respected counsellor who had deliberately told his girlfriend that her daughter was dead in order to separate them. A counsellor who had systematically beaten his girlfriend until she left in fear of her life. A girlfriend who had kept photographs of her injuries and had them verified by a doctor. Okay, so Monica had lied about that bit, but she said her blood was up by then and she just wanted to be sure she would win. I like the sound of Monica Dormer. The shocking thing was how easily the Villiers man had caved in. He went very quiet, then said, "What do you want?" He had married, you see, and had 2 young sons, and when Monica told him that Letty would know, one way or the other, what he had done, she had thought from his voice that this was a conversation he had probably expected for some time. They struck a deal. Restore the child to her mother, and this would remain a family matter. He agreed a little too readily. She had the impression that it wasn't the happiest of families. This is the best part. He had known where Liza was for years, through his contacts in the police, probably, or some kind of private investigator. The irony was that he had wanted her to stay away from him as much as she had wanted to stay away. He said his mother had told Liza the child was dead, partly because at that point they thought it might be true, and partly out of spite. Then, when they discovered that Liza had disappeared, they'd decided it might be useful to let her believe it, that it would be an easy way to have her out of their lives. She was a loose cannon, a threat to his career and his future, an obstacle to his happiness with the elegant, dark-haired Deborah. And they had what they wanted. He had the grace, she said, to look a little ashamed. He wanted proper access, he said, the kind of man who at least wants to behave as if he still has control of a situation. And Monica told him he could have his access as much as his daughter wanted. Then, accompanied by a lawyer and with a child psychologist at the ready, Mike's sister was a little afraid by then, never having dealt with children herself, they went to the house to tell Letty she was going on holiday. It was quick. We worried later that it was too quick, given the shock that the girl experienced on being told that her mother had not abandoned her after all. But, sounding as unsure as Mike had ever heard her, Monica admitted that until they left the drive, she had been afraid Villiers would change his mind. There were so many lies that Letty would have to learn to disbelieve, so many secrets. Mike's sister said she was a bright kid, that she wanted to know everything. It was night time there now, and they were letting her sleep, but in the morning, our evening, Monica would ring us, and, after 5 years, Liza would be able to speak to her, her younger daughter, her baby, risen from the dead. I saw the light on in the Whale Chasers Museum as I let Millie out for her last walk of the night, and I guessed pretty quickly who it might be. I don't bother locking it half the time, there's nothing of monetary value in it to steal, and Millie would let us know if strangers headed up here when they shouldn't. Liza and Hannah were upstairs making their telephone call, and they needed to be alone, so I grabbed a couple of beers and went out there. He was probably feeling like I was, a bit of a spare part. This was Hannah and Liza's time. We could be happy for them, overjoyed even, but in truth, not yet knowing Letty, we could only ever feel a fraction of what they did. Being in that house while that conversation was going on upstairs felt intrusive, like listening in on someone's love affair. Besides, I was curious about what Liza had told me the previous day, before her whole world had changed again, about the possibility that the development might not go ahead. It was nothing certain, she said, and she was not meant to tell anyone until it was confirmed. But she said it was down to Mike, and then, her face darkening, she said that he would be leaving for good tomorrow. and after that she wouldn't say much at all. He didn't hear me at first. He was sitting on one of Maui II's rotten timbers, one hand resting on it, and his shoulders were stooped, as if he were carrying a great weight. Given what he had achieved, it seemed an odd stance. Millie shot in past me, wagging her way to him, and he glanced up. "Oh, hi," he said. He was almost directly under the strip lights, and they cast long shadows on his face. "Thought you might like this." I held out a beer to him. As he took it, I sat down on the chair a few feet away and cracked one open myself. "Not like you," he said. "Nothing normal about today," I said. We sat and drank in companionable silence. The barn doors were open, and through them, in the near dark, we could see the shoreline, the distant lights of people's cars, of fishermen's boats preparing for their night's work. The gentle, humdrum life of Silver Bay pottering on, as it had done for half a century. I still couldn't believe what I'd been told, that it was possible Mike could pull us back from the brink. I couldn't believe that we might be allowed to stand undisturbed for a little longer. "Thank you," I said quietly. "Thank you, Mike." He looked up from his beer. "For everything. I don't understand how you've done it all, but thank you." His head dropped again then, and I knew something was wrong. The dark, contemplative expression on his face suggested that he was not out here to give Liza space. He was out here because he had needed to be alone. I sat and waited. "I've been around long enough to know you catch a hell of a lot more fish by keeping still and quiet." "I don't want to leave," he said, "but it's the only way I can stop the development. I'm not sure I understand." "There was a choice, and I couldn't make it hers. She's had to make too many hard decisions already." He was holding so much to him, I swear he could hardly move. "I want you to know this, Kathleen. Whatever you might hear in the future, whatever you hear about me, it's important she knows she was loved." His eyes were burning into me. Their intensity made me a little uncomfortable. "I don't want you to think badly of me," he said, choking, "but I made a promise." "You really can't tell me what any of this is about?" He shook his head. I didn't like to push him. Call me old-fashioned, but I think a man becomes physically uncomfortable if you make him talk too much about what he's feeling. "Mike," I said finally, "you saved Liza. You saved both my girls. That's all I need to know." "She'll be happy, right?" He wouldn't look at me now. I had a bad feeling about why that might be. "She'll be okay. She'll have her girls." He stood up and walked slowly round the room, his back to me. I realized then how sorry I was that he was going. Whatever wrongs he had done us, he had put right in spades and then some. I'm no great romantic. Lord knows Nino Gaines could tell you that. But when it came to him and Liza, I had hoped for a happy ending. I knew now that he was a decent human being, and there are few enough around. I would have told him as much, but I wasn't sure who would be more embarrassed. He stopped in front of my Shark Lady picture. When I sensed he might be a little more comfortable with proximity, I raised myself out of my chair and walked over to join him. Still in my original frame, sepia-tinted and yellowed with age, still flanked by my father, Mr. Brent Newhaven, and their invisible wires, there I was, smiling into that camera, my 17-year-old bathing-suited self, preparing to pursue me through the rest of my days. I took a deep breath. "I'll let you into a secret," I said. "I never caught that ruddy shark. That got him. He faced me." "Nope," I said. "My dad's partner caught it. Told me it would look better on the hotel, give us more publicity if it came from me." I took another draft of my beer. I hated lying. Hate it still. But I understand something now. If it hadn't happened, this hotel would never have survived the first 5 years. Or it could have been a 6-story development for the last 20, Mike said wryly. I turned the picture to the wall. Sometimes, I said, a lie is the way of least pain for everyone. I placed my hand on Mike Dormer's arm and waited until he felt able to look at me again. He nodded towards the door as if we should go, and we glanced up at the house where Liza's bedroom light still glowed in the dark. You know something? I've never seen a tiger shark in this bay. Never, I said, stepping out into the dark. Greg has, he said, as he made to close the doors behind us. You're not listening, said the shark lady.
27. Mike. I had 1.5 suitcases, and the empty space within them was so great that I could almost have fitted one inside the other. That space seemed to echo my state of mind. I would be the only passenger, I thought, who was likely to be penalized for underutilizing their weight allowance. Somehow, during my time here, I had shed half of my wardrobe, so that all I wore now, day after day, was one of my 2 pairs of jeans, perhaps a t-shirt and shorts if it was a really warm day. Not a lot to show for such a seismic period in my life, I thought, as I placed them on my bed. I guessed I could buy my parents a hell of a lot of duty-free. I was not taking my oilskin. Somehow it was too bound up with being here, and I didn't want to look at it hanging up in the wrong surroundings. I was not taking my suits, which I had given to the Silver Bay charity shop. I didn't pack the t-shirt I'd been wearing when Liza first came into my bed, or the jumper I had lent her the night we had sat out by ourselves until 2 a.m., and which I secretly hoped she might want to keep. I was not taking my laptop. I had left it in the living room for Hannah, knowing it would be of more use to her. Besides, it might only be a matter of hours now until Letty returned to them, but I couldn't bear to separate Hannah and Liza from that pixelated image. It might sound odd, but it would have felt like tearing them apart all over again. They both sat in front of it for hours, talking, comparing Letty and Hannah's faces, considering the myriad different ways in which they had changed and not changed. Liza was out on Ishmael, her last trip before they, too, left for the airport. I had hardly seen her since the previous day, and wondered whether a quiet exit with no goodbyes might be the best thing for both of us. I told myself that at least they would be occupied. This afternoon they would finish doing up Letty's room. Hannah had been allowed the day off school, and they had spent the previous evening painting and putting up new curtains, filling it with the kinds of things a 10-year-old girl might like, and arranging Letty's dolphins. Hannah was up there now, music blaring, pinning up posters that she would tear down in a fit of indecision. "Do you think they like this group in England? What do English girls like?" she would ask me anxiously, as if I were likely to have a clue. As if it were likely to make a difference. I watched all this from a distance, half removed from their happiness, too consumed with the prospective loss of my own. They might miss me a little, but they had a far greater prize to contemplate, and a whole new life ahead. Only I was likely to shed tears tonight. I looked out at the little bay, at the distant mountains, and at Silver Bay's scattered rooftops. I listened to the birdsong, to distant engines, to Hannah's music thumping above me, and felt as if I was being wrenched from my home. What was I going back to? To a woman I was not sure I could love in a city that now stifled me. I thought of having to pick up the pieces of my old life, revisiting once familiar bars and restaurants with braying city acquaintances, forcing my way through crowded streets, shoehorning myself into a new job in an anonymous office block? I thought of Dennis, who would doubtless convince me to return. And what was the alternative? Then I pictured myself stuck on a train in a new suit, closing my eyes to imagine Hannah tearing down the beach with Millie at her heels. I thought of Vanessa's smile, her perfume and high-heeled shoes, our smart apartment, my sports car, the trappings of our former life, and knew, with a sick feeling, that it meant nothing. I wanted to be here. Every last atom of me wanted to be here. The worst of it was that I still liked Vanessa. I still cared about her happiness, and I cared about my own integrity. For those reasons alone, it was important that if she held true to her promise, I should hold true to mine. Those were the words I would repeat to myself silently several hundred times a day. Then I would visualize the months ahead of lying awake at night, with Liza's face, her intermittent smile, her knowing, sideways glance haunting me. I would imagine burying my face in the one T-shirt that might still carry her scent. I would make love to someone whose body did not instinctively fit my own. "Come on," I told myself sternly as I walked briskly to the hire car to bring it to the front of the hotel. Liza had her girls, and I was about to secure their future. 2 out of 3 was a pretty good strike rate for anyone. I reversed into the front space, then sat staring at the dashboard. I had finally mastered the weird gear stick, and, as I turned off the ignition, that small fact bugged me more than anything. My flight was not due until the following morning, but standing there, increasingly swamped by my thoughts, I decided I had to leave now. I would drive to the city and book a room in a hotel for the night. If I stayed an hour longer, my resolve might melt. It meant that I would not see my sister, that I would not witness the reunion, but I knew Monica would understand. If I stayed till tomorrow, if I fooled myself for 5 minutes that I was any part of that new family, I might not be able to do the thing I had promised. I got out of the car and turned to the road as I heard a familiar whine. Greg's pickup skidded into the driveway, then shuddered to a halt, his bumper a few inches from mine, buoys and fishing nets colliding noisily with the back of the cab. He climbed out, pulling the brim of his cap over his eyes. "I heard the news about the little one. Unbelievable! Unbelievable!" "News travels fast," I said. But it was a platitude. Hannah had run to the jetty the previous evening to tell every one of the whale chasers individually. They didn't know the full circumstances, but they knew Liza had had a daughter in England who was to be returned to her, and they were astute enough not to look beyond what they had been told. Not obviously, anyway. "Arriving tomorrow night, is she?" I nodded. He pulled a packet of cigarettes from his pocket and lit one. "Good on you, mate. I can't pretend I like you, but struth, I can't argue with someone who brings children back from the dead, eh?" He took a deep drag of his cigarette. We both stared for a minute at Whale Jetty, where only Greg's boat remained. "Thanks," I said finally. "Yeah, well." Behind us, in the hotel, a telephone rang. Probably some future guest. It would not be Monica. She had been in the air for several hours. Kathleen had offered to put her up for as long as she wanted to stay. It was the least she could do, she said, beaming, and I felt suddenly envious of my sister. Tomorrow night she would be sleeping in what I now thought of as my room. Silver Bay was about to be consigned to memory. A strange little period in my life that I would look back on wistfully, a series of what-ifs that I would not allow myself to consider too closely. Thinking about my sister made me remember my cases, and I went inside to fetch them. When I carried them out, Greg was still leaning against his pickup. He looked down at my luggage, then up at me.
Going somewhere?
London, I said, swinging them into my open boot. I closed it with a thud.
London, England?
I didn't bother to respond.
Staying long?
I wanted to lie to him, but what would have been the point? He would know soon enough. Yes. A slight pause. A few calculations.
Not coming back?
No. His face actually lit up. He was as transparent as a child.
Not coming back? Well, now, that's a shame. For you, I mean.
I heard him take another drag on his cigarette, heard the smile in his voice when he said,
I always thought you were an odd one, mate, and now I know I'm right.
Quite the psychologist, I said, jaw tightening. I wished he would get lost.
Leaving us all, eh? I'm sure you've made the right decision. Best to stick where you fit in, eh? And I'm sure Liza will get over it. She'll be a different character now, I reckon. A whole lot happier. And, well, you don't need to worry at all. I'll make sure she has enough attention.
He raised an eyebrow at me, delight written all over his face. If it hadn't been that Hannah might be watching us, I would have punched his stupid face in. I knew he half wanted it. He'd been spoiling for a fight with me for weeks. If I remember rightly, Greg, I said quietly, it wasn't you she was interested in. He took a last drag of his cigarette and spat it into the dust.
Ah, mate, he said. Liza and I go back a long way. I'm a big guy. As far as I'm concerned, you were just a distraction.
He held his finger and thumb about a centimetre apart.
A little blip on the old radar.
For a moment, the gloves were off. It was as well that Kathleen emerged from the house.
Mike, she called, her voice indignant. What are you doing with your caters? I thought you weren't going till tomorrow.
I tore my gaze from Greg and went towards her. I'm waiting for a call. Then I think I'll head off. She stared at me. Then at Greg.
Don't look at me, said Greg, grinning. I've done me best to tell him just how much he's wanted.
You want to come in for a minute? She asked me.
Don't mind me, Greg shrugged.
Never have yet. I followed her into the front room.
You can't leave now, she said, her hands on her hips. You won't see Letty. You haven't said goodbye to anyone. Hell, I was going to do you a little party tonight.
That's really kind of you, Kathleen, but I think it's best if I go.
You're not even going to hang on till Liza gets back? Say goodbye to her?
Best not. She stared at me, and I wasn't sure whether it was sympathy or frustration in her face.
You really can't hang on? Just till after lunch?
I tried to think clearly over the sound of Hannah's boombox, which was pumping out disco music upstairs, my heart still thumping with thwarted adrenaline. I could hear her singing, her reedy little voice breathless and faintly out of tune. I stepped forward and held out a hand. Thanks for everything, Kathleen, I said. If any calls come here for me this afternoon, will you give them my mobile number? I'll call you as soon as I know for certain about the development. She looked at my hand, then up at my face. I found it difficult to meet her eye. Then she hugged me, her old arms surprisingly strong as they held me to her.
You call me, she said into my shoulder. You don't get to disappear just like that. Doesn't have to be about the ruddy development. You call me.
I walked out of the room, out of the hotel, and into my car, before the pain in her voice could change my mind. I had to drive slowly down the coast road, not because its surface was potholed and uneven, but because there seemed to be something in both of my eyes and I couldn't see straight. When I got to Whale Jetty, I stopped to wipe them, and found myself hoping against hope that I might see Ishmael coming round the head and into the bay, that I might, one last time, see the thin figure, the hair blowing under the cap, and the dog steering in. Just one little glance before my life continued its own separate course on the other side of the world. But there was only the glinting water, the strings of buoys that marked out the boating channels, and on the far side, the hillsides of pine stretching up to the blue sky. I couldn't think about what she would say when she returned to find me gone. I hadn't even been able to write her a letter, telling her what I felt would have meant telling her the truth, and I couldn't do that. "You've done the right thing," I told myself, heading back on the coast road. "For once in your life, you've done a good thing." I had done the right thing so seldom that I didn't know whether the terrible sense of dread I felt was the right emotion to go with it. I had been on the highway for almost 20 minutes when my mobile rang. I pulled onto the hard shoulder and rummaged in my jacket pocket. "Mike? Paul Riley. This is a courtesy call, really. I thought you should be the first to know that the development isn't going ahead." She'd done it. I let out a long sigh, not sure whether it was with relief that Vanessa had done as she'd said, or resignation that I had to keep my side of the bargain. "Well," I said, as a truck rumbled past, making the car tremble, "I know we differ on this, but I'm glad. Bundaberg really is the better option." "Can't see it myself. I thought that development would have been a real asset to this area." "You've got something rare here, Mr. Riley," I said. "At some point you and the other half of Silver Bay will realize that." "Pretty unusual for someone to pull the plug so late in the day. I mean, they were after putting the foundations down this week." His voice lifted in resignation. "But you can't argue with the money men." "Beaker will have done their research," I said. "If they thought Bundaberg had the better margins, then..." "Beaker? It wasn't Beaker." "Sorry? What did you say?" The cars and trucks kept roaring past, sporadically drowning his words. "It was the venture capitalists, the finance. They pulled the plug unless the site was changed." "I don't understand." "They got antsy about the shark, apparently. They heard about all the newspaper reports and warnings not to let people in the water and took fright." He sighed. "I guess from their point of view it's going to be pretty hard to sell water sports holidays to people if they think there are sharks, but really I think they got it all out of proportion." He sounded pretty disappointed. "Seems British people hear the word shark and all reason goes out the window," he added. Why would Vanessa go to Valence first, I wondered. "You've surprised me, Mr. Riley," I said, my mind working. "Thanks for the call, but if you'll excuse me, I need to speak to someone." I sat for a moment, barely noticing the traffic that hurtled past. Then I reached into my briefcase for my laptop, realizing too late that it wasn't there. I stared at my bags, then wrenched the car back onto the highway and accelerated hard to the next exit. "Dennis?" "Michael? I wondered how long it would be before you rang, you old bastard. Rung to gloat, have you?" He sounded well lubricated. It would be almost 11 at night there, and knowing Dennis, he would have had a few. Or a few more than a few. "You know that's not my style. I was driving while I was talking and had to wedge my phone between ear and shoulder as I negotiated the roundabout back into Silver Bay. As I headed towards the hotel, the car bounced over the potholes and I wondered absently how much I'd have to pay the rental company for busted suspension.
No, I forgot you'd turned into Mother Bloody Teresa. What do you want? Calling to beg for your old job back?
I ignored him. So where's it going?
Little town just outside Bundaberg.
I heard him take a drink of something.
Be even better. VCs are happy. Local council is 100% behind us. We're using the same model. Heaps better tax breaks. To be honest, you did us a favour.
There was nobody outside the hotel. I walked through the front door, down the hallway, and into the deserted lounge, my phone pressed to my ear, and made for my laptop. It was still where I'd left it. Upstairs, Hannah's music was still blaring. I doubted she'd noticed I'd gone.
I did you a favour. Freaking the VCs out, your lobbyist bombarding them with shark tales.
My lobbyist? This was weird. Dennis, I...
What did you do? Hire some professional crusty from Greenpeace?
He dropped his voice.
Between you and me, I have to admit you did a good job sending all those newspaper reports about sharks. I was pissed off at first. We had to work 4 days and nights straight through just to keep the deal on track and Valance on board. But now I think about it, we wouldn't have made any money in shark-infested waters. Much better off up the coast. So, who was it? More importantly, how much did you pay them? I know professional agitators don't come cheap.
He hadn't mentioned Vanessa. While he was talking, I'd opened my computer. I glanced down the record of emails sent, trying to work out what had happened.
So, what's your next move, Mike? He was saying. Going to do this professionally? You know, I made good on my promise. No one will touch you in the city.
I sorted my outbox into recipients and found the emails that had been sent to Valance. I opened one, noted the scanned newspaper attachments, and began to read.
That said, boyo, if you're desperate for a job, I might be able to find a small opening. To do you a favour. Nothing like the same salary, you understand.
Dear sir, it began, I am writing to let you know of the risk of shark attack at the new Silver Bay development. I did a double take, read on, and as I read, I began to laugh.
Mike?
She had done what I had failed to do. She had done what I had thought was impossible.
Mike?
The music was louder. I heard the singing, and just for fun, I held the phone up to it.
Mike, he said again when I put the phone back to my ear. What the hell is that noise?
That, Dennis, I said, is your professional agitator, your overpriced lobbyist, your reverser of multi-million-pound developments. Can you hear it?
What? He was saying. What are you going on about?
That, I said, laughing again, is an 11-year-old girl. I had one more call to make and walked outside as I wanted to be assured of privacy. I stood for a moment before I dialed, breathing in the undisturbed scents that had been there for half a century and would now remain, if lucky, for half a century more. But I didn't feel any sense of peace. Not yet.
So, you did it then, I said.
She caught her breath, as if she had half expected it to be someone else.
Mike, she said.
Yes. You heard. I told you I would.
You certainly did.
Oh, you know I always get what I want. She laughed, then began to talk about the apartment, how she had booked a table for the night of my return at a restaurant that it was near impossible for mere mortals to enter, Her voice was light. She always spoke a little too fast when she was excited. "I've pulled a few strings, and we're eating at 8:30. That should give you plenty of time for some sleep and a shower."
"How?
How did I get a table? Oh, you've just got to know the right..."
"How did you persuade your dad to turn everything round?"
"Oh, you know, Dad, I can twist him round my little finger. Always could. So, are you still on the Qantas flight? I've taken time off to meet you. I think I've got the number written down."
Must have been hard, though, him having convinced Valance to go so far down the line.
"Well, I just..."
She sounded vaguely irritated.
"I went over the reasons you and I had discussed, and by the end of it he saw sense. He listens to me, Mike, and we had the alternatives ready, as you know."
"How did Valance take it?"
"Fine. Look, can we talk about your flight?"
"No point."
"Don't you want picking up? I was going to bring you a surprise, but I can't resist telling you. It's the new Mazda two-seater, the one you ordered. I managed to get it off the dealers at the original price. You're going to love it."
"I'm not coming, Ness." I heard a sharp intake of breath.
"What?"
"How long had you known when you rang me?" "I just checked the emails that went to Valance from our end, and I guess you must have known for, oh, 2 or 3 days at least that the development was to be shifted." She said nothing. "So, you thought I'll capitalize on this little opportunity and make myself out to be the great savior, earn Mike's undying gratitude?"
"It wasn't like that." "Did you think I wouldn't find out that it wasn't down to you? Do you think I'm stupid?"
There was a long silence.
"I thought by the time you found out, we'd be happy and it wouldn't matter anymore.
Our whole relationship would have been based on a lie."
"Oh, you're a fine one to talk about lies. You and Tina, you and that bloody development."
"You would have let me come all the way back, uproot my whole life on a..."
"On a what? Uproot your whole life? Oh, don't make yourself out to be some great victim, Mike Dormer. You're the one who did me a wrong, if you remember."
"Which is why I'm not coming back."
"You know what? I didn't even know if I really wanted you back. I would have let you come back and chucked you out on your ear. You're worthless, Mike, a lying, worthless piece of nothing."
She was raging now, the discovery of her duplicity having sent her over the edge.
"I'm glad you know. I'm glad you found out. You saved me a bloody journey to the airport, and frankly, I wouldn't touch you again if..."
"Good luck, Vanessa," I said icily, as her voice rose another octave. "All the best for the future." My ears were ringing when I flipped my phone shut. It was all over. I stared at the little phone in my hand, then hurled it as hard as I could into the sea. It landed with a half-hearted splash 30 feet out. I watched the sea close over it and felt such extreme emotion erupting inside me that it was all I could do not to roar.
"God!" I shouted, wanting to punch something, wanting to turn cartwheels. "God!"
"I'm not sure he'll hear you," came a male voice from behind me.
I spun round to see Kathleen and Mr. Gaines sitting at the end of the whale chaser's table. He was wearing a blue fleece and his bush hat, and they were watching me calmly.
"That was a very nice phone, you know," Kathleen told him. "This generation is so wasteful. They're all the same." "Emotional, too. We didn't do all that yelling in my day," said Mr. Gaines.
"I blame the hormones," said Kathleen. "I think they put them in the water."
I took a step towards them. "My room," I said, trying to slow my breathing.
"Any chance I can
keep it a little longer?
Reckon you'll have to check your books, Kate, Mr. Gaines said, leaning into her.
I'll see if it's still available. We'll be getting busier now that we're the only hotel in the bay. I'm not normally a sticky beak, she added, but you were yelling some.
I stood there, my heart rate slowing, grateful for the two gently mocking old people before me, and for the sun, the benign glinting blue of the bay, the prospect of creatures dancing joyfully unseen below the water, for the thought of a carefree young woman in a battered old cap out somewhere chasing whales. Kathleen motioned to me to sit down and pushed a beer towards me. I took my first delicious gulp. I love this beer, I thought, as I lowered the cold bottle from my lips. I love this hotel, this little bay. I love the prospect of my future life, which was unfolding before me, with its reduced income, its cranky teenagers, bad-tempered dog, and houseful of difficult women. I was unable quite to grasp the magnitude of what had happened. Kathleen caught it.
You know, she said, after a few minutes, lifting a crepey hand to her forehead, all sorts of people are pro-shark these days. They'll tell you that sharks are misunderstood, that they're the product of their environment. She curled a lip. I say a shark is a shark. Never yet met one that wanted to be me friend. That'd be right.
Mr. Gaines nodded in approval. I leant back in my seat, and the three of us sat in silence for a while. Down the coast I could see the building site with the glossy boards, which would soon be redundant. I could hear the music upstairs in Hannah's room, the roar of a distant motorboat, the dull conspiratorial whispering of the pines. I would stay here for as long as they would have me. The thought filled me with the closest thing to contentment I have yet known.
Greg never caught that shark, did he? I said.
Kathleen Whittier Mostyn, legendary shark lady, laughed. A short, fierce bark of a laugh, and when she turned to face me, there was a steely glint in her eye.
One thing I've learnt in my 70-odd years, Mike. If a shark wants to bite you, as far as I'm concerned, you do whatever the hell you have to just to stay alive.
28. Hannah. It takes 3 hours and 28 minutes to drive from Silver Bay to Sydney Airport, another 20 to find a decent parking space, and on top of that, in our case, 4 further lots of 15 minutes stopping time for me to be sick out of the back door with nerves. My tummy still gets me. It was like that every time I went out on a whale-watching trip, and I never could persuade Yoshi it wasn't seasickness. Auntie Kay knew. She told me every time that it didn't matter. While my head was in the gutter, I heard her telling the others she'd brought 8 plastic bags and 4 kitchen rolls in expectation, and Mike had set off an hour early, thanks to her warnings. There were 5 of us in the car, Mike, Mum, Mr. Gaines, Auntie Kay, and me. It wasn't our car, but Mr. Gaines's 7-seater, which we borrowed, after Mike pointed out that Mum's car couldn't accommodate the 1 extra person coming home. A convoy of trucks, trailing bits of net and lines, and probably smelling of fish, all pretending not to be there, was following us. Every time we stopped, they stopped too, but none of them got out. They just sat and looked out of the window, as if they were interested in anything but the girl with her head in the gutter. If it had been any other time, I'd have wanted to die of embarrassment. No one had wanted to come too close, knowing what my mum was like about her privacy, but everyone had wanted to be there. My mum didn't care. To be honest, I don't think she'd have noticed if the Queen of England had turned up to watch. For 24 hours, she had hardly spoken, just stared at her watch and calculated, and occasionally reached out to hold my hand. If Mike hadn't stopped her, I think she'd have moved into the arrivals lounge 2 days ago and waited there. Mike's calculations were spot on. Even with our extra stops, we got there 15 minutes before the flight arrived.
15?
Mr. Gaines muttered.
Of the longest minutes of our lives.
At least 20 more, Mike calculated, for baggage and passport control. And for every single one of them, their mum stood as still as anyone ever had, her hands gripping the rail while we tried to make conversation around her, eyes on the gate. At one point, she held my hand so tightly that my fingers went blue, and Mike had to get her to let go. Twice, Mike went to the Qantas desk and came back to confirm that the plane had definitely not dropped out of the sky. Finally, just as I thought I might be sick again, the first trickle of passengers from flight QA2032 came through. We stared in silence, each of us straining to see the distant figures through the swinging doors, trying to match that image with the one we had on a crumpled bit of paper. What if she didn't come? The thought popped into my head and my heart filled with panic. What if she'd decided she wanted to stay with Stephen? What if we stood there for hours and no one came? Worse, what if she came and we didn't recognize her? And suddenly, there she was. My sister, almost as tall as me, with Mum's bright blonde hair and a crooked nose like mine, holding tightly to Mike's sister's hand. She was wearing blue jeans and a pink hooded top and walked with a limp, slowly, as if part of her was still afraid of what she might find. Mike's sister saw us and waved, and even from that distance, you could see the smile on her face was as big as a mile. She stopped for a minute and said something to Letty, and Letty nodded, her face towards us, and they began to walk faster. We were all crying then, even before they had reached the barrier. My mother, silent beside me, had begun to shake. Aunt Kathleen was saying,
"Thank God, oh, thank God,"
into a handkerchief, and when I looked behind me, Yoshi was crying into Greg's chest, and even Mike, his arm round my shoulders, was gulping. But I was smiling as well as crying, because I knew that sometimes there's more good in the world than you can possibly imagine, and that everything was going to be all right. And as Letty got close, Mum ducked under the barrier and started to run. And as she ran, she let out a sound I'd never heard before. She didn't care what anyone thought. She and my sister locked eyes, and it was as if they were magnets, as if there was nothing in the world that could stop them moving towards each other. My mother grabbed her and pulled her in, and Letty was sobbing and had hold of Mum's hair. And the only way I can describe it is to say it was as if each of them had had a piece of themselves given back. I pushed through then, and I held on to them too, and then Aunt Kathleen and Mike, and I was dimly aware of all the people watching who must have thought she was just another kid coming home. Except for the noise. The noise my mother made as they sank to the floor, surrounded by all of us, wrapped in arms and kisses and tears. Because the sound that came from my mother as she rocked my sister in her arms was long and grievous and strange, and spoke of all the love and pain in the world. It echoed through the great arrivals hall and bounced off the shiny floor and off the walls, stopping people in their tracks and causing them to peer round to see what it was. It was both terrifying and glorious. It sounded, Aunt Kathleen said afterwards, exactly like the song of a humpbacked whale.
Epilogue. Kathleen. My name is Kathleen Whittier Gaines, and I'm a 76-year-old bride. Even to say those words makes me wince with the silliness of it all. Yes, he caught me in the end. He told me if he was going to pop his clogs, he'd like to do it knowing I was nearby. And I figured that was not a lot to ask of a woman, not when she knew she had been loved by a man her whole life. I don't live in the hotel anymore. Not full time, anyway. Nino and I couldn't quite agree on where to settle. He said he had to be near his vines, and I told him I wasn't going to spend the rest of my days inland. So we split our week between our two houses, and while the rest of Silver Bay thinks we're a pair of mad old coots, this is an arrangement that suits us both fine. Mike and Liza live in the hotel, which is probably a little smarter and a little more welcoming than it was when I ran it alone. Mike has fingers in other pies, interests that keep him busy and bring in some money, such as marketing Nino's wines, but I don't pay much heed, as long as we have a bottle or two of something nice on the tables in the evening. Every now and then, Mike gets ideas about making more money or increasing yields or whatever the hell it is he talks about, and I disagree, and the rest of them nod and smile and wait quietly for him to blow himself out. There will be other developments and other threats, and we'll keep fighting, but now we do it without fear. Nino Gaines, or should I say my husband, bought the old Bullen place. A wedding present for me, he said. A bit of security for the girls. I don't like to think too hard about how much he paid for it. He and Mike have ideas for the space. They occasionally go down together to the faded hoardings and walk the land, but when it comes down to it, neither of them seems like they actually want to do anything. And I get on with doing what I always have, running a slightly ramshackle hotel at the end of the bay and getting a little fidgety if we have too many visitors. Down the coast road, the southern migration is shaping up just fine. There are reports every day of pods, mothers and babies, and on the surface, passenger numbers are pretty well what they were at the same time last year. The whale chasers come and go, the occasional new face replacing the old, bringing the same salty tales, the same jokes and complaints to my benches each evening. Yoshi went back to Townsville to study whale conservation, promising to return, and Lance often talks about visiting her, but I doubt he will. Greg is courting, although that may be too delicate a word for it, a 24-year-old barmaid from the RSL, and she seems to give him as good as she gets. He spends less time around the hotel anyhow, and I can see that suits Mike fine. And Letty thrives. She and Hannah hang on to each other as if it was 5 days they were separated, not 5 years. Several times I've found them sharing a bed and made to move them, but Liza says not to bother. Let them sleep, she says, looking at them entwined. They'll want space from each other soon enough. When she speaks, there's such a lightness in her voice that I can't believe she's the same woman. The first few weeks were strange. We tiptoed round the child, afraid that this strange series of events, this sudden shift of circumstance, would leave her shattered. For a long time, she stayed glued to her mother, as if afraid that she would be ripped apart from her again. And in the end, I took her down to the museum and showed her my harpoon, and told her that anyone who thought they were coming near any of my girls would have old Harry to answer to. She was a little surprised, but I think she was reassured. Nino tells me dryly that there was probably a reason I never had children. She was better once her father had called. He told her he was happy for her to stay here and would allow all decisions to be hers. From that point on, she slept properly, albeit in her sister's bed. And there it ends. Mike's sister, true to her word, never printed her story. Mike says it's actually a love story, not about him and Liza, although you only have to look at them laughing together to know that's the case, but about Liza and her daughters. Sometimes, if he's teasing me, he says it's about me and Nino. I tell him I don't see it that way. Look out at the sea for long enough, at its moods and frenzies, at its beauties and terrors, and you'll have all the stories you need, of love and danger, and about what life lands in your nets, and the fact that sometimes it's not your hand on the tiller, and you can do no more than trust that it'll all work out okay. Almost every day now, if Liza doesn't have too many trips booked, they head out together on Ishmael to see the whales still making their way back to their feeding grounds. At first, I thought it was Liza's way of creating a family, of binding them together. But I soon realized that they were as drawn to it as she was. It's not just about the creatures they see, they tell me. It's about what they don't. The girls like to watch the humpbacks disappear, enjoy the thought that, after some spectacular breach, there's a whole life beneath that they cannot see. Songs being sung into an abyss and lost forever. Relationships being forged. Babies being nurtured and loved. A world in which we and the mindless things we do to each other are unimportant. At first, Mike laughed at them for being fanciful. But now he shrugs and admits, what the hell does he know? What does any of us know? Stranger things have happened, especially in our little corner of the world. And I watch the four of them now, running down Whale Jetty in the sunshine, and I think of my sister, and perhaps my father, who would have enjoyed a story like this. We thought you had company, I tell them, wherever they are, but boy, were we mistaken. They would have understood that this story is about an elusive balance, about a truth we all struggle with whenever we're blessed enough to be visited by those creatures, or indeed, whenever we open our hearts, that sometimes you can damage something wonderful merely through proximity. And that sometimes, Mike adds firmly, you don't have a choice, not if you want to really live. I never let him know, of course. I can't let him think he has it all his own way. But I have to say, in this case, just in this case, I agree with him. The end.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Silver Bay by Jojo Moyes. This programme was executive produced by Patty Perouz, and produced and directed by W.F. Howes. Silver Bay is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. The book Silver Bay is available wherever Penguin books are sold.